Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from the newsroom of PCJ Radio International. It's 10 years since the then head of Fiji's military, Frank Bainimarama, seized power in Fiji in the country's fourth coup in 20 years. Mr. Bainimarama remains in charge after a landslide election victory 2 years ago. To mark the 10th anniversary, Sally Round has been asking people about their personal memories of the coup and how they see Fiji a decade. Amnesty International says there are positive signs that Fiji may be taking steps to end the culture of torture and brutality in the security forces. The organization has released a report into several cases of torture and how justice is often delayed or denied. To coincide with the 10th anniversary of Frank Bainimarama's military takeover, Amnesty International's Pacific researcher Kate Schultz says people are still being violently assaulted by security forces that act with relative impunity. But she told Jamie Tahanaha there have been some positive signs of progress, although it still is a long way to go. Dawn.
On December the 5th, 2006, Ben Davetta was a boy of 12 living in Nandi when he heard a live broadcast from the capital, Suva, announcing the military takeover.
I was scared, and I was actually with my grandmother. I was sitting right next to her. I could see her. She was worried. She actually cried, and when I saw her crying, I began to have this feeling of fear.
As of 6 o'clock this evening, the military has taken over the government, has executive authority, and the running of this country. I urge all citizens to remain calm and maintain the peace that currently prevails.
Frank Bainimarama's announcement brought back memories for Ben Davetta of bloodshed and horror during the 2000 coup.
My grandmother held my hand and she started praying. She was worried, she was thinking about Fiji. She prayed for the country, she prayed for the leaders, and she prayed for the lives of the citizens.
As the coup unfolded, the then Public Service Commissioner, Stuart Huggett, met government department heads to work out what to do after advice the takeover was illegal.
I went to see Commander Bainimarama to let him know what was happening and what the general opinion was. It didn't quite work out like a meeting. I got knocked over and abused. It got a bit unpleasant, and Bainimarama was very annoyed by the idea that it was an illegal coup.
The roadside attack involving what he describes as a bunch of military left him with a broken foot.
Angry was the strongest emotion. I didn't think that it was justifiable to perform like that, actually. It seemed very strange. I still don't understand it. I think it affected me a bit. Yeah, I think I was a bit shaken for a while.
In the ensuing days, more checkpoints and soldiers appeared on the streets. Ben Davetta says people were afraid to move about.
Young kids were scared to go to town because there were military people there. Soldiers were on the road, fully armed with guns. If we are playing at rugby and there's a military truck or a military van passing by, someone will yell out, "Hey, there's a military truck," so everything will stop.
The coup followed a standoff between Frank Bainimarama and the Prime Minister Laisenia Ngarase, which embroiled New Zealand and Australia. The government's proposals to give immunity to perpetrators of the 2000 coup and to return foreshore resources to traditional owners had raised the tension, as well as talk of the commander's arrest after the deaths of mutineering soldiers 6 years earlier. Semi Korui Lavasau was in the tourism business at the time, running cruise ships around the islands.
I supported it for a good reason. I thought there were some initiatives being taken by government at that time that would have direct impact on the tourism industry. And we actually thought, oh my God, you know, this is the end of tourism in Fiji.
Frank Bainimarama eventually allowed elections in 2014 and won a landslide victory. The years of military rule had shaped the teenage Ben Davetta's interest in politics, democracy and indigenous rights. He eventually joined one of Fiji's opposition parties, disgusted over human rights abuses and a dismantled Great Council of Chiefs.
I felt that something is wrong, and the very first wrong was way back on the 5th of December 2006. So from then, I believe that I have to be one of the young people that need to stand up and have a say and make Fiji end the coup culture.
Semi Korelavasau, the former cruise ship operator, is now a minister in Mr. Bainimarama's government. He says 10 years on, Fiji is undergoing unprecedented development, is more efficient, less corrupt.
The annual budget for Fiji for this year almost has quadrupled to about $3 billion. You can sort of calculate the amount of trading and revenue within the country. They've tidied up everything that was on the loose. They have developed an era where they have gone out of the traditional way to do things.
Semi Korelavasau says Fiji has achieved new heights on the world stage, chairing the next world climate change talks, COP23.
The Prime Minister was in the forefront of climate change, representing all the Pacific Islands, being the biggest voice for the small island states in the Pacific. Fiji has greatly achieved a lot of things, and the visibility of Fiji in the international arena now is much bigger than ever before.
Stuart Huggett left Fiji straight after the coup and wasn't allowed in for a couple of years. He says corruption claims against his architectural firm were never substantiated, and Mr. Bainimarama's so-called clean-up campaign was just a smokescreen.
The coup leader and his plotters are still in power. If it was illegal then, whatever they've done since could still be described as illegal, I suppose. Fiji is able to survive and thrive in spite of coups, as it's proved in the past.
Mr. Huggett now travels freely between New Zealand and Fiji, where his firm still operates. The respected economist and academic Wadan Nasi has remained a fearless critic of the Bainimarama regime since the coup. He says the people of Fiji will be paying for the government's largesse for generations to come.
What the public see at the moment, of course, is Bainimarama throwing the cash around, spending money here and there, and basically buying voters. What they do not see is that in 10 years, he's built up the public debt by $2 billion. I mean, that's a massive amount of money for a small economy like Fiji.
Professor Nasi has found it increasingly difficult to get his work published in Fiji, and he says he's leaving the country for good. This is Sally Round.
Amnesty International says there are positive signs that Fiji may be taking steps to end a culture of torture and brutality in the security forces. The organization has released a report into several cases of torture and how justice is often delayed or denied to coincide with the 10th anniversary of Frank Bainimarama's military takeover. Amnesty International's Pacific researcher Cage Sull says people are still being violently assaulted by security forces that act with relative impunity. But she told Jamie Tahanaha that there have been some positive signs of progress, although there is still a long way to go.
What we found was that there are a range of issues which entrench impunity. I mean, some of these cases are coming to light and they're not being investigated or not being investigated with due diligence. So what we've seen in the YouTube video which emerged in relation to Iowini Benedito, who was beaten in 2012, it took nearly 2 years before they opened up a proper investigation and started to charge officers involved in that incident. We've also got constitutional immunities, which now say that government officers can't be held accountable. So people who might have been tortured as little as 2 years ago don't have access to justice in those cases. You know, so we have seen this happen from time to time. And one of the significant problems that we think is important to talk about around the 10-year anniversary of the coup is, you know, the role of the military in civilian policing. And I think it's important on the 10-year anniversary that we start to talk about, you know, what more can be done on these cases to move things forward in Fiji, to ensure better accountability when it does arise, and to make sure that the security forces are actually complying with their own laws.
In the case of Benedito, as you point out, it took 2 years for an investigation to start. There's many other cases where we're not sure there has been an investigation at all, or it just kind of disappears after a while. Why is that?
I mean, so what we're seeing is that there's been a number of high-profile cases in the last few years, and raising the profile of these cases in some instances has led to limited accountability for those cases. In Fiji, the systems and processes aren't set up well enough in law, policy and practice to stop these instances occurring. We have seen some positive signs and we've spoken to government about this. They are talking about, you know, a first-hour procedure for persons in custody, making sure they have access to lawyers and family members the moment that they're taken into custody. And what we're saying here is that there's much more that needs to be done But when it does occur, we also need transparency, you know, accountability for these cases, as unfortunately is the exception rather than the rule. And what we want to see is that turned on its head.
These are the cases we know about, though. I mean, the report suggests, and of course reports we've had suggest, there are many more going on where nothing happens at all.
Yes, I mean, what we see around the world is that the number of people that feel comfortable reporting cases of torture and ill treatment, the ones that are willing to come forward, are significantly lower than the cases that are out there. We are only referring to the high-profile cases where they're felt comfortable making a complaint either to the courts, through the justice system, to the police, or to the media. You know, so the reality is that these cases are probably only the tip of the iceberg. So what we need to see is an improvement in the police complaints process so that people know how they can actually make a complaint. You know, when those systems are lacking and not there, people are less likely to feel comfortable reporting these matters to the police. You know, we've also seen in this case in La Toca that a person who made a complaint against torture has been harassed and threatened in his home since he made that complaint. And, you know, that kind of behaviour is very concerning and it's absolutely unacceptable.
So does this suggest that there needs to be some kind of independent body that has some kind of power to investigate?
Yeah, so I mean, essentially we don't take a view on what that mechanism should be, but international law does define what are the characteristics of an independent investigation process. So in some states we see that there is a crimes and misconduct commission, or there might be a police ombudsman. You know, Fiji does have a human rights institution, so there is potential scope to either a sub institution outside the police force reviewing these cases, or to build up the Fiji Anti-Discrimination and Human Rights Commission and give them the powers to do those things.
Recently, in the past year or so, we've seen both Frank Bainimarama and Sitiveni Ngilio both admit to an extent that there is a problem with violence and torture. The Human Rights Convention has been ratified and such. Is there any sign of action following these pledges?
Yeah, I mean, essentially we saw, doing this report now was because we see an opportunity in this shift in government attitudes. You know, we have moved a long way from a couple of years ago, Bainimarama saying, I'll stand by my men, to a few weeks ago at this torture convention saying, look, there is a problem within our security forces of resorting to violence and we do need to change that. We are providing a roadmap essentially for government to try and address some of these issues. If it is committed to addressing torture and ill treatment, they will take on board some of our recommendations and we always remain willing and open to engage with them and discuss how they can meet those international standards.
A Canadian woman in Fiji has been forcibly deported just hours after appearing before a parliamentary select committee. Karen Seaton, who holds a Fiji residency permit, was taken from her Sava hotel and forced onto a plane to Los Angeles without explanation. Ben Robinson-Drawbridge reports.
Karen Seaton had made a verbal submission to the committee on behalf of expat landowners affected by changes to the Land Sales Act. Act 16 requires all non-resident landowners to construct a US $120,000 dwelling by the end of the year or pay a fine every 6 months equal to 10% of the value of their land. Ms. Seaton says she was taken from her Suva hotel room on Friday night by immigration officials.
They broke into the room and I, at that point, made a formal request for an ambassador. It was denied. They forcibly twisted my arm to remove my phone from me, and they forcibly took my purse from me to take my passports. And I, at one point I asked, why was I being deported? And she just said it's from the highest authority in the nation.
Ms. Seaton's submission had been facilitated by the former opposition leader Mick Beddoes. He says Act 16 applied retrospectively to all non-resident landowners when it was introduced in 2014.
And most of these people are abroad and they're planning to come and retire on their plots of land that they bought for their retirement. And we all know that retirees don't have a whole swag of money. This idea of forcing people to build a $250,000 home, and if you're retiring in the countryside, you need a nice, comfortable little cottage that'll probably cost you less than half of that. And why would you penalize a group of people and not apply it across the board to everybody? That is just unjust and unfair.
About 5,000 expat property owners are represented by the Fiji Landowners Association. Its US-based founder, Dave Rand, says Act 16 targets mostly white landowners as well as Fiji's property market.
There's another motive, far more sinister than what would appear on the surface, and that was to, you know, artificially crash a real estate market and then get people to conduct a fire sale, which is going on now. Places are being sold for a fraction of the value they were 10 years ago. And lo and behold, the people that are scooping up these properties in this fire sale are mostly Chinese and local Fijians, or Chinese going through local Fijians to avoid any circumstances going forward.
Mick Beddoes says wealthy Fijians will buy up the land sold by expats, as he suspects the government will soon relax restrictions on land sales abroad.
They're forcing the sale of this land to locals, and only certain locals can buy it. And it wouldn't surprise me that before the 2018 elections, a new bill will come in to relax the restriction of selling abroad. And that's just daylight robbery.
Fiji's acting Prime Minister, Ayaz Sayed Kayyum, did not respond to requests for comment. This has been Robinson Drawbridge.
And you are listening to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Just to inform our listeners right now who are tuning in to the weekly international edition, the following weeks of the 16th, 23rd, and 30th of December, we are going to be presenting some special programs as the team for Focus Asia Pacific is taking a holiday. Those who listen to the three times daily 15-minute edition will catch the program as normal. Police have been at a loss to prevent a surge in tribal fighting in Papua New Guinea's Hela province. The Highlands province is the hub of the country's major Left Field Natural Gas, or LNG, project, which is actually led by ExxonMobil. While tribal fighting is not being linked to the project, the role of the police and their links to the project are being questioned. Johnny Blades reports.
Tribal fighting's not new in PNG's Highlands region, particularly in Hela. But Hela is a newly created province and problems around tribal enmities are surging. A Hela-based community worker, Isaac Pulupe, says there's recently been a lot of lawlessness in Hela.
Tribal fighting. We have about 10 fresh conflicts which has involved people being losing a lot of property. Out of that 10, some conflicts have about 11 to 12 lives being lost. It's not really good, and people are taking extra precautions when they want to travel around Hela.
The provincial police commander, Michael Welly, concedes Hela has had its fair share of tribal fighting this year.
It's nothing to do with political, it's all tribal fight, mainly due to disagreements in the community about land issues and other various domestic issues that then turns out to, you know, all tribal fights, you know.
Hela's Como region remains tense after an ambush on a convoy at a roadblock 2 weeks ago left two people dead. The next day, in pursuit of the suspects in the shootings, the police mobile squad, a highly trained yet notorious group of armed police from around PNG, went to Lagame village. Lagame locals say the squad burnt down many homes, something which Michael Welly played down but stopped short of denying.
To go in search of the suspects. Obviously, they went there and everybody did them, so obviously one or two houses were put up in flames, yeah.
The mobile squad has been linked by various locals to the LNG project, with some describing these police as LNG security. However, a statement from an Exxon spokesperson denies this.
ExxonMobil PNG plays no role in the conduct of police operations, nor do we hire the police or employ what was described as LNG security police. Under the Project Gas Agreement, the state is responsible for protecting project operations in a lawful and reasonable manner that respects human rights.
Under a memorandum of understanding with the PNG Police Force, the LNG project says it can offer support such as transport, fuel, lodging and stipends for the police away from their normal work locations. But Isaac Pulupe says the community feels the police are not working on their behalf to stop tribal conflicts such as that in Como.
Tribal fighting has been going on in Como, one that leading to the shootout. And it is right when the LNG was operating and it's in the heart of the LNG. And it is one of their Papua New Guinea police constabulary mandate to intervene and to stop tribal rioting and any sort of conflict. But to them, they didn't do that.
Meanwhile, local media is reporting that the roadblock at Como has been cleared, opening up cautious hopes for peace between the conflicting tribes involved. This is Johnny Blades.
Traditionally, Cook Island leaders say they've been blocked from delivering a message to the European Union to keep out of their waters. Under an agreement, the Cook Islands government has granted four European purse signers the right to fish for shipjack tuna in exchange for $7 million. Joe O'Brien has more.
Prior to a public meeting on the agreement, traditional leader William Framhein said they plan to give this advice to the EU representatives who were expected to attend.
The European Union is told stay in their ocean and to keep out of our moana, to leave our resources alone, our pay moana, for the people of our country.
But Mr. Framhein says they were later told by Deputy Prime Minister Mark Brown that he would not expose the EU officials to the traditional leaders.
We're gutted, disappointed, and we've made it known to the minister that basically the government has snubbed us as traditional leaders and have no respect for our custom.
Mr. Framhein says instead they were only able to deliver their message to the Secretary of Marine Resources, Ben Ponya. Mr. Ponya says some of the agreement's opponents have already made up their minds and won't be swayed by facts.
We're being detracted by misinformation, to a certain degree by emotion, that's not allowing logic to prevail.
The Marine Resources Secretary is adamant the deal with the EU is a sound agreement for the Cook Islands.
We have an obligation. We have a very important fishery to manage. It is an economic resource that serves the country's needs, that pays for the salaries of teachers, contributes to social welfare. So we have to be very mindful of what's at stake here.
Ben Ponya says under the agreement, financial support will also be given to help develop the local fishing industry. A senior EU official who attended the meeting also believes the agreement has been misunderstood.
We were under the impression that there was a sort of interpretation that our fleet could come here and fish indefinitely whatever kind of quantities we could have been finding in these waters, but this is not the case.
Instead, he says, the 7,000 tonne a year catch limit the agreement sets is based on scientific estimates made by the Western and Central Pacific Fisheries Commission and the Cook Islands of what can be sustainably extracted.
It's really, I would say, a kind of insignificant amount. You have to take into account that in Western and Central fisheries part of the world, the total catches in 2015 of tuna fish have been 2,687,000, and we're talking about 7,000.
But traditional leader William Framhein questions the accuracy of his government's data on the health of the fisheries.
Our local fishermen are the real source of data, the real data. They're the ones telling us that there's no fish. Fish are getting smaller. Fishermen are having to travel further afield to catch large fish. The real issue is a decline in tuna in the Cook Islands.
The EU spokesperson is also countering concerns that purse seiners rely on fish aggregating devices that attract other species into their nets.
Our fleet is really up to speed with the most modern approach avoiding these non-targeted bycatches. And in particular, they are all using what we call non-entangling FADs, these fishing aggregating devices, which actually avoids the entangling of non-targeted species.
But traditional leader Kio Matarua says there is great opposition from all sectors of society to the decision to allow the EU purse seiners in.
I do hope the government will think and reconsider their position and acknowledge that people of the nation are up in arms with this particular agreement.
However, Marine Resources Secretary Ben Ponya says they intend to pursue the agreement despite legal action seeking a judicial review. He says he expects the first payments from the EU before the end of December. This is Joe O'Brien.
Tonga has been sent its first ever consignment of squash from China. Squash remains the main agricultural export from Tonga, from Korea and Japan, the traditional markets. The chief executive of Tonga's agriculture ministry, Vamia Amano, told Don Wiseman a critical factor is being able to service those markets in late November and early December, when Tonga is able to command the better prices.
We had a partnership negotiating with China to open the market for squash. And we've been doing that since last year. And finally, this season, we were planning on opening the market with 200 tons, but the team of inspectors pre-assessing the cargo before it leaves Tonga only arrives late, so only one 40-foot container was left, which is about 24 tons.
Going back a wee way, squash was a very important part of the Tongan economy, wasn't it? But yet it fell away. Why did it fall away?
It was a combination of different factors. Sometimes it's the weather, sometimes it's the market price. If the weather is good for the Japanese season, then the season will be longer, because the window that Tonga is targeting is only about 2 weeks, the first 2 weeks of December. I think, and also the last week of November. If we miss that, then we either arrive, the squash would coincide with the squash from Mexico.
How important is the Japanese market at this stage?
It's still the biggest source of foreign revenue in terms relative to the other export of root crops, vanilla. Vanilla, for some strange reason, had a high price last year. Something happens with the biggest supplier from Madagascar and the price shoots up to about $60 per kilo for the dried beans. But the last week, since July this year, we saw a rise in the export of frozen products, mostly cassava and yams, processed and frozen and to New Zealand. So we're not sure, maybe it's because the supply from Fiji has been affected from cyclone earlier this year. We're not sure whether we're going to hold that volume, or maybe when Fiji is coming back, we might drop back. But squash is still the main earner of foreign revenue for Tonga.
Just how important is it in terms of what it earns for the country?
Squash, I think, and vanilla is the only crop that I could grow as much as many areas as I could. I'll be sure to market it, which is different from watermelon and cassava. I could easily grow 100 acres, but in terms of marketing, we have a lot of problems in logistics and also finding markets. But if I could grow 100 acres of squash, I can be sure to market it.
This shipment to China, you anticipate getting a decent price for that?
We're not really sure about the Chinese market, because before it was the Japanese market, and the minimum weight for fruit for export is 1.2 kilograms. But when the Korean market opened, they allow down to 900 grams. So you can export your smaller squash to Korea and then some of the main ones and the rest to Japan. So we're not sure what the Chinese market would demand. There's a lot of things that we have to know about the Chinese market.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Just a reminder again that the editions, the 30-minute edition, the one you're listening to now, which goes out globally once a week for December 16th, 23rd, and 30th, will be special editions. In the Pacific, where those of you who listen to the daily, three-time daily, that is, edition of Focus Asia Pacific, you will be getting that program as normal. Yes, anyway, running out of... I forgot actually what I was going to say. That doesn't really matter. Anyway, if you want to get in touch with us, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, and take care.